up against lunch, and it's never something you want to be up against. I did not realize the time that I'd be up against lunch. So, thank you. Everybody have a source sheet, even if you don't have. Sharing is caring. Okay, first of all, a big thank you to the YU Kolon, to Neely, for this really a tremendous event every year, coming together, taking your time to come and learn, especially before Tisha B'Av. So a thank you to the Kolel. For those that don't know me, my name is Aaron Liebtag. You've heard of Rabbi Liebtag. Those are probably my uncles, which are very famous. I have a shul here in Chicago in KJBS. I also get a chance to teach in Hillel Torah with some of my esteemed colleagues who are here. It makes you even more nervous when you talk in front of your own very esteemed colleagues. So I hope I do it justice. Okay, so when I saw the calendar, and I realized that as a shul rabbi, I'm already in Tisha B'Av mode. I don't know, probably since Shavuos. But I told Rabbi Brand recently that the preparation for Tisha B'Av was probably the three most depressing weeks of my year. But when I realized that today we're less than a week to Tisha B'Av, that we should do something that touches upon the issues that surround Tisha B'Av. So what I would like to do is talk about tolerance. But hopefully with a little bit of a different spin on it, and tie that into the Tisha. But let me just start with a short story. The story takes place in the 1930s in Yerushalayim. It's not on your story sheets. And the story is between a Rav Moshe Blau, who was the head of the Aguda, and extremely involved in the old Yishuv of the more, we'll call it, right-wing element in Eretz Yisrael, and Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, who was also more right-wing. And they were walking out of a building, and there was Tu B'Av. Tu B'Av in the religious Zionist circles, today still, but much earlier, Tu B'Av represented a ceremony, not just celebrating trees, but celebrating the land of Israel, and the resurgence, and the rebirth. So these two tremendous Torah personalities, I mean, Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld was of the greatest of the greats. And they're walking down the street, and there was these young boys and girls in some type of parade, some religious Zionists or regulars, whatever it was, there was a parade. They were marching down, and they had their flags. Right, you can't have a parade without flags. So they're marching down, and he sees all these young boys and girls. I don't remember, they were dressed, or whatever the story is. So this person says to Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, he says, maybe you want to go back into the building. I don't know, maybe it's not so appropriate. Maybe we should just go back into the building. So he says to them, you're talking about a few thousand, it was a big parade. He says, are these not Jewish children? He says, we're going to stay. And as the whole parade passed him, he hears of Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld murmuring under his breath, Yosef Hashem alakechem aleichem yabenechem, you should be blessed upon you, children of Israel. And that's how I want to frame it in that discussion. Another story quickly, Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, one time, Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld and Rav Kook did not get along in their ideals. But, unfortunately, as we'll talk about, today leaders get along, constituents don't get along. So one day, Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld is leaving the Kotel, and Rav Kook is walking into the Kotel. And it was Pesach time. So Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld turns to Rav Kook, and he says to Rav Kook, next year you should be standing in blood up into your ankles. So Rav Kook bows and thanks him, and he walks to the Kotel. So of course, the students were like ready for a brawl. They said to Rav Kook, no, how come you didn't have a one-liner back? Today it's all about one-liners. So Rav Kook says, you don't understand. Rav Kook was a Kohen. The Gemara says that when we offer the Karban Pesach, there will be so much blood of the Karbanos that the Kohanim will be standing in blood. He wasn't out to get me. He was telling me that maybe we disagree, but we understand each other. But what I want to do is I want to talk about tolerance, because when you talk about tolerance, everybody goes, for sure. Everybody's nodding. For sure, tolerance. Because those other people are so intolerant. Right? Obviously, everybody in this room, everybody is tolerant, and everybody is a tremendous person, wholehearted, shalem, complete, beautiful, and sweet. But perhaps if there is somebody here who might not be a little bit tolerant, maybe this will help you. Because when we talk about tolerance, it's a very important issue. Let's begin. If you look at the first source, the most important, there is no more buzzword today in politics than tolerance. Everybody talks about tolerance. Tolerance in the Jewish community, tolerance between different segments of Orthodoxy. In my shul this past Shavuos, we did a whole theme on the role of community, on shiurim, on how do we deal with non-religious and reform, conservative. Politics is all about tolerance. And yet, what's fascinating is that those that believe they are tolerant are, in fact, usually the most intolerant people, I tell my students all the time, now you have to follow this, that open-minded people sometimes are very narrow-minded, that you are not open-minded. Right? Open-minded people are narrow-minded, that you're not open-minded. How could it be? Aren't you open-minded like I am? So let's talk about it. Now, it's very important to talk about tolerance when it comes to the Jewish community because, we'll talk about Tisha B'Av in a little bit, Rav Kook tells us that the Jewish community functions different than everybody else. And in fact, if you look in the middle, about the fourth, fifth line down in the middle, says Rav Kook in his Orot, this is not the case regarding Israel, the soul of the individual is drawn from the community. The community bestowing a soul upon the individual. One who considers severing himself from the people must sever his soul from the source of its vitality. Therefore, every individual Jew is greatly in need of the community. We could talk for hours about the role of the community, the role of tzarchi tzibor, the role of chesed, the role of tzedakah, the role of sacrificing oneself for the community. Your stories in, through the Crusades and in the Holocaust, all of these issues. But that's not what I want to talk about. Right? We could go on to a million tangents, and I'm going to try not to. I want to keep it focused. I'm not really good, but we'll try. Okay? Now, here's the problem. Because when you talk about tolerance, everybody should love each other. But look what the Torah says. Torah tells us the following in source number 2. And it's a little strange because it gives us what seems to be two different types of ideals. Number 1, lo sista es achicha bilvavecha. You cannot hate somebody else. Okay? Hocheach tochiach es amisecha. But you also should do what? Rebuke somebody else. Now, we're not really going to talk about rebuke, but how does that work? How, on the one hand, can I say, I love you, you're amazing, you're the best? On the other, I have to tell you, you're a pretty terrible person. I mean, some of these things that you're doing are just wrong, right? What's rebuke? Rebuke, now obviously, you have to be able to accept rebuke. I cannot rebuke somebody halakhically if you will not listen to it. It doesn't work. But rebuke means that I'm able to say to you, I'm not going to point out names, I know. I could, but that would be my last year in this Yarchei Gala. Right? But we could point out people and say, you know, I remember one year in school, about 2-3 years ago, we were having a conversation about different segments of Orthodoxy. And a certain student of mine got very upset how other students were talking about, you know, conservatism and that we should just accept everybody. And I said, it's a very fine line. On the one hand, you of course want to accept everybody, but on the other hand, you can't condone everything and say, it's amazing. It's amazing, whatever you want to do, you can do. We have laws. We have laws. In fact, the rabbis even tell us, and I'll tell you the source outside, source number 3, you can turn the page, but the rabbis even tell us that Hashem himself doesn't like certain people. How can that be? That even God himself doesn't like when people, Hashem hates, so to speak, hates 3 kinds of people. So the question number 1 is, how do we relate to people who are wrong? If I come across somebody and they're doing something wrong, what's my role? Do I rebuke them? Do I not rebuke them? Do I feel better than you because I am not doing, you know, I always say when a person finishes Shemona Esrei, so the first thing that they do, before talking, the first thing that they do is look around, right? Because the guy that's still davening, or the woman that's still davening, frumi. I mean, so frum, you're still davening. And the person who's finished davening already, they have no idea how to daven. You know how long Shemona Esrei should be? However long I said it was supposed to be, right? Because my davening, I know how to daven. Now, so number 1, and this is probably, if you're going to take one thing away, will be, I'll say that like 4 times, should be this source. And that's source number 4 from the Netziv. Now the Netziv, when Talit Yehuda Berlin lived in the 19th century, headed, you know the story of the Netziv as a boy, right? You know the story of the Netziv as a boy?
No.
Oh, yeah, come on. So, we'll go on a tangent, but this isn't allowed because it's talking about the Netziv. The Netziv, it was a genius of a mind, obviously. He ran something called the Volozhin Yeshiva. He became the Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhin Yeshiva. The Volozhin Yeshiva closes down in 1892. Maybe one year here, we'll do a whole story about that. It is a fascinating historical study. Why did the yeshiva close? They were open. They were really one of the foremost in terms of what a yeshiva looked like. In the old days, there was no yeshiva. You didn't go to day school. Either you learned and you got a meal somewhere, and by 11 or 12, you became a carpenter. The real geniuses got a cheder maybe, got a malami to come teach them, got somebody, a rebbe, a mora. There was no day school. The Volozhin Yeshiva really was the first, but the Russian government wanted them to introduce secular studies. And that became a major debate in this, in the hierarchy of the Vlajin Shiva, what to do. And they allowed some in, they didn't allow certain things in. The legend has it that in 1892, the Netziv himself puts the lock on the door and says enough, because it was getting too infiltrated by the secular world. But the Netziv was a little boy. And the story goes like this, that he tells the story actually. He tells, at a siyum he made later in life, he tells this story. So it's fascinating. I remember I heard this first when I was a kid. You all think, oh, you're a rabbi. So if you're a rabbi, you must be really smart and remember everything. And everything is not true at all. I can show you my SAT scores. Okay? I don't remember much. But when I was in sixth grade, we had a speaker. And she scared the living daylights out of us. I don't know why anybody would come to sixth graders and tell them that at the end of your life, you're going to watch two videos, one of which is the life you live, one of those life you should have lived. And that, why would you tell it to a sixth grader? Okay, but obviously it stuck with me. But then they took, this is the first time I heard the story of the Netziv, which is, you know, shared in a million different places. The Netziv is a little boy, and he wasn't behaving so well in yeshiva. So back in those days, it doesn't work. You don't behave in yeshiva, you're out. So the Netziv is out. They kicked him out. And he's upstairs in his little house, and he hears his parents in the basement, on the dining room table, whatever it was. The mother's crying. She's crying. Why is she crying? Because what's he going to do? He's going to become a carpenter. I mean, we want him to stay in the school, learn a little bit more. So the Netziv runs down the steps, tells his parents, give me one more chance, right? Get me back in, give me one more shot. I'm gonna learn. All right, so they get him back in. Just like then, you can't really kick a kid out of school, right? I'm saying, that was 1850s, just can't do it. So, goes back to yeshiva, becomes a Netziv. But he says that at the end of his life, he was going to die 120 years, go up to the heavens, meet the angels, and the angels were going to say to him, ah, B'Naftali Tzvi Yehuda, we're so excited to have somebody of your ranks join the heavenly court. And they would have said, what do you mean? I'm a shoemaker, I'm a carpenter, I'm a woodworker, I don't know what you're talking about. No, you wrote this great sefer. And he went, I didn't write any sefer. Maybe you got the wrong guy. And he says, I would have lived an entire life not knowing what I could have fulfilled. I would have given tzedakah, I would have davened, I would have learned, but I would not have written what I did and, you know, made the impact that I did. So that's the story of the Netziv. It says the following. If you look in the underline, okay, so the Netziv has an introduction. The Netziv is one of the most original Perushim on Chumash. The Netziv says that Sefer Bereishis is called the Sefer HaYashar. What does Yashar mean? Straight. Okay. In directions, it means go straight. What does it mean to be in this idea? So listen to what the Netziv says. I'm going to read some of this in the underline because it is so powerful. If inyan dinis ba'er b'shira sa'azino ala pasak atzor tamimpa, although we talk about Hashem, is sadik v'yasharu. Deshevach yasharu ne'amar lehatzdik din HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What does it mean to be yashar? B'chorban b'yasheni shadar uvikeshu v'sal tol. Then when the Beis Hamikdash were destroyed, they were twisted. U'peirashu shetzadikim v'chasidim v'amalei HaTorah. They were great righteous leaders and thinkers and philosophers, but you know what they weren't good at? They weren't good at being good people. Yeah, they could learn up a storm and they could answer any shaila in the book, but they couldn't deal with you. And he says, "Al came im nesinas chinam shabilibam ze ze chashduas mishrosh noik shelo kidatam." If I saw somebody acting not like I did, I said, "Oh, you're apikores, you're a heretic. My way is the best way." And he says, who is the greatest proof of this idea? It is none other than Avraham Avinu. What made Avraham so great? Says the Netziv, if you look, Shakarash Baruch in the second group of other lines, Yashar v'enu savat tzadikim kilo ba'ofen sholchim b'derech ha'yashar gam b'halichus olam. That's what makes Avraham so great, was that he could find monotheism, find God, teach Torah, and also welcome in three random strangers. Three guys that were worshipping Avodah Zarah. The three angels that came to Avram's tent were worshipping Avodah Zarah, and Avram says, come on in. So Avram's, the Lubavitch Rebbe says, Avram is more universal. Sarah, though, is more particular. You need a little bit of both. You need a little bit of both. But what makes the others great? Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov wasn't that they found God. Wasn't that they could daven Shachris Mincha Maariv. They established the Tfilos. What made them great was that they were able to interact with people. And that's what the Netziv says. It's an amazing idea. In the last few lines he says, or the last word is mikol, mikomakoma, you imam ba'ahava, v'chashul letovasam. He loved people. And now sometimes that did not do well with Avraham. He loved people so much that who does he fail to see? Is a bad influence.
Yishmael.
Ah, Yishmael. And okay, you have to have a balance. But what makes the Avos great is their ability to interact with people, even those that they don't agree with, that they don't see eye to eye with. So that's what the Netziv says. For the interest of time, we're running out of time. We're going to skip the Rav Kook at the bottom. I'm going to turn to your attention to the next page. Not only do I have to understand that I have to... Today, we've lost this. There was a study done by the Wall Street Journal a number of years ago about how communities today, forgetting Jewish communities, communities today are built around it's homogeneous communities. I live in the district of how I'm going to vote and what news I'm going to watch. And in fact, in today's age, with technology, you never have to hear something that you don't like. It doesn't work. I can make my playlist for what I want. I can get the podcast what I want. And if you have an album and you don't like the song, what do? You skip it. Or delete it.
Yeah.
Right? Or give it to your kids and then you break the CD. But either way. Today, we've lost this art of interacting and respect. And now, if you don't agree with what I... And it's seeped down into the religious world, into the Jewish world, for a long time already. We're going to talk about Tzinas Chiyam in a minute. Says the Baal HaTanya in source number 7. The Baal HaTanya was the great Rav Shneur Zalman of Lidai, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he writes here in the underline in source number 7, but as for a person who is not one's colleague and is not one's intimate terms with him, Hillel the elder said, be of the disciples of Aaron, loving peace, pursuing peace, loving the creatures and drawing them near to the Torah. This means even in the case of who are moved from God's Torah and His service, and are therefore simply as creatures, one must attract them with strong cords of love, perchance one might succeed in drawing them near to the Torah. Nobody has ever gotten somebody closer to Torah simply by yelling. But when we hear it, so of course we'll get personal for a minute. We hear it, but we sometimes don't think that we're at fault for doing something like this. You know, I remember a few years ago in Beit Shemesh, it was a terrible, terrible thing, right? And the crazies with the tznias, and they were spitting on people, right? So we're shaking our heads, right? So now let me ask you a question: the fact that we're not going to go outside today. At the end of the day, what are we going to say? I love other Jews. You know how I know I love other Jews? Because today, I didn't spit on anybody. I mean, it's amazing. I didn't spit on anybody today. So, yes, there is extremes of intolerance. But just because I'm not the extreme, doesn't mean that I'm necessarily doing what made the Avos great. And that is really what the Baal HaTanya suggests. You know, I remember when... The idea of half Shabbos was introduced a few years ago. Right, there was this idea that there was people and there was kids, they were texting on Shabbos, and it was terrible, and it was an epidemic, and it was a plague worse than the plagues of Mitzrayim. What are we ever going to do? Chalila, it's the worst thing in the world. And it was bad. Okay, and today it's actually dipped off a little bit because, I mean, at least I can see even in middle schoolers and high schoolers appreciate a day of disconnect when we're so connected. But that's for a separate time. But now, I was going to talk about it in my shul actually at one point a few years ago, and we brought in a guest speaker. And usually, when a guest speaker comes to your shul, you talk with them. And this was actually a friend of mine. And in his speech, he sort of drops this idea: "Yeah, there's texting on Shabbos. Have a great Shabbos, KJBS. I'm flying back to New York." And now everybody's like, "Wait, what did he say?" And I'm like, "Thank you, Rabbi Aryeh Lightstone, who's now the assistant to the ambassador of Freeman in Israel. So he did well for himself." But so a mentor of mine wrote an article in which he said, we can't, it's not half Shabbos. This is half Shabbos. Well, because that's wrong. I mean, I can tell you myself, I definitely don't keep all the Thirah Malachos all the time. Every single one of them, Kedasu Kedin, halachically approved, 100%. Does that mean that I'm a half Shabbos Jew? I mean, you aren't going to invite a speaker and speak in the Archi Kala, that's half Shabbos? All right, we struggle with things, but if we always look down upon everybody else, and instead of looking into what we are doing, so that doesn't do well for our community. So let me do the following. That was sort of to present this idea that since the beginning of time, from the Avos, tolerance has been an issue. how we relate, how we respect with those who are different than us, with those who believe things that are different than us, with those who are religiously different than us. But what I want to do for the remaining time, and if you turn the page, again, it doesn't mean that I have to, it doesn't mean that if somebody comes to my shul and says, well, I don't know, I don't believe in God, but I for sure would like an aliyah and want to daven Yom Narayim for the Amud, but I don't believe in Hashem, I'd be like, you're amazing, I love you, for sure. There are limits, but those limits have to come. You know, I had a number of years ago, somebody was in the process of converting. Well, he was beginning. He converted many years ago in a non-Orthodox conversion. And he wanted to convert. I thought he wanted to convert to Orthodoxy. So he met me in my office one night, and I said to him, okay, so listen, here's what we're going to learn together. Here are some books on halacha and Jewish law to buy. He goes, no. You understand? I don't believe in Jewish law. I'm like, okay, well, let's start. He said, well, I don't believe in God. I'm like, all right, well, this is not really going to work then. I mean, I still take his membership. Don't get me wrong. Sometimes when people that are not in my shul, they'll, you know, especially kids or kids' parents that I taught, I become a rabbi for them. So they text me halachic questions. So after, sometimes if I know the couple or the family really well, after I answer their question, I'll send them the link to my donation page on the shul website if they, you know, they were so inclined. But I would like to talk for a minute that how this presents itself in Tisha B'Av. So we have taught, you know, I didn't really want to title my shiur something about Sinas Chinam, because if you see the word Sinas Chinam, you're like, all right, okay, like, I know, basis hatred, basis amigdash. So what I would like to do is not talk about that, but talk about it at the same time. What does this mean, this idea of Sinas Chinam? Does it mean like I woke up one day, and I'm just like, I don't know, I'm going to hate this. I've got like a list. Like today, that's the guy I'm going to hate. That's how the base, that doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense at all. So what I'd like to do is show you a different approach to Sinas Chinam. The first, actually, in something just to note, is in source number 11 from the Maharal. We might be familiar with the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Where the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa in 30 seconds, my father and I, for many years, we'll learn these Gemaras together on Tisha B'Av. Now we don't have the chance now. Also, my father lives in Israel, so the time is a little bit different, but for, I don't know, a good... First, when I was a little boy, my father would drag me to Kinos. There was no full-day presentation. It was like, sit there, and we're going to say, I mean, for hours. Then in the afternoon, we would go to learn with my shul rav, my father and I and my shul rav, we learned these Gemaras, Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, for 2 or 3 hours. So the Gemara tells a story about a guy who had a party. And he has a friend, Kamsa, and an enemy, Bar Kamsa, and basically they invite the wrong guy, and that leads to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. We can look it up later. But at the end of the day, his name wasn't Kamsa, and his friend, enemy's name really wasn't... His mother didn't say, Kamsala, it's dinner time. Right? So what does it mean? Why is the Gemara called Kamsa and Bar Kamsa? So the Gemara says, the first lesson to understand it's Sinas Chinam, and this is very true today, is that sometimes we make friends with people simply because they have enemies with somebody else. I'm not really your friend. So the guy who had the party, whose name we never know, which is fascinating, it's for a separate time, his friend really wasn't Kamsa, but Kamsa became his friend because they had a mutual enemy called Bar Kamsa. So first is, are we honest with our relationships and in being able to tell people, what's happening? Like, what are you... But no, I'm going to join you. I'm going to join in this fight. But if I were to tell you, give me the reason the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, you would have said, everybody knows Sinas Chinam, but look at the Gemara at the bottom. Source number 12. I'm going to quote for you about 5 or 6, actually, other ideas of why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Number one, says the Amora Abaye, lived in the 5th century of Amoraim, V'charbu Yerushalayim, Ela B'shvil Shechilu Es HaShabbos. They were Mechal Shabbos. That's it. That's what Abaye says. Abaye was a really important Amora. There's no Sinas Chinam there. Says Rabbi Abbo, number in the second one, in the second underline, B'shvil Shebitlu Kriya Shema, Shachar Svi'arvis. They didn't say Kriya Shema. How many of you ever heard this Gemara? I'm telling you, I didn't know this Gemara until about a year ago. I'm telling you. You're a rabbi. I know. Okay. See, that's the one thing I'll admit to you. Amar Rav Hamnuna. Second is, B'shvil Shebitlu HaTinoko Shel Beis Rabban. They didn't allow their kids, they discontinued Torah study for the children. You have another one. They weren't embarrassed of each other. The Gemara has more and more on the next page. So I ask you, where is Sinas Chinam? So one of the ideas of Sinas Chinam is that Sinas Chinam is a social pathology. It is when I believe that I am better than you. And I believe that the way that I have carved out my Judaism, which is also a problem today, that I've carved out in such a way that if it changes a little bit, or you tell me that it's wrong, who are you? I have plenty of rabbis that tell me what I'm doing is correct. So, for example, Shabbos. What Shabbos, we say Shabbat Shalom. Why do we say Shabbat Shalom? Shalom means harmony. It means peace. Shabbos should welcome any time of peace. There is no better time, no more peaceful time in the calendar year than Shabbos and Friday night. In fact, there's one prohibition in the Torah about what we can't do on Shabbos. That is, you're not allowed to make a fire. The Zohar says it's a fire. You have to put out the fire of anger. So when the people weren't doing this, it wasn't that they weren't just keeping Shabbos. There were in peace between people. This social pathology doesn't look like hatred. It's not that I get up and I say I hate everybody. The Nili Archigala. Maybe that would be odd. It would be weird. No one does that. And it can't be that everybody did it, that destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. It's masked in many different ways. How about Shema? In Shema, the theme of Shema is the love of God. You can't love God, and we'll talk about this hopefully as we finish, if we don't love each other. It's called projection in psychology. That sometimes we think God hates us because we don't like each other. That's number two. Tinoko shel beis rabban. I mean, is there no more fitting idea? If you look at some of the epidemics facing certain communities and schools, you can't get into this school, you don't fit our hashkava. Right? We're like a certain kind. There's an amazing video online, which you should watch. It's great, because usually when I speak, it's on Shabbos. I have to tell people, later tonight, then they don't remember that. Right? But now, you can really, when you finish this, you can watch it. Which is why, as a rabbi, I just make up half the things, and no one's really going to look after Shabbos, right? So, there was a great Gadol Hador, just passed away about a year or two ago, whose name was Rav Ari B'Leib Steinman. He was a big Gadol Hador in Bnei Brak, one of the leaders, and there's a great video. These two guys come to him from some cheder, whoever it was, and they say to him, they want to kick a kid out. He's not their hashkafa. So Ari B'Leib Steinman says, oh, where's he going to go? I don't know. I don't know where he's going to be. He can't come in our school. Our cheder is not for him. So he's a little meshuggah. So Rabbi Leib Steinman looks at these two rebbeim. He goes, you think he's meshuggah? Maybe you're the ones who are meshuggah, right? Just because you have so carved out what this, you know, they tell story of Rav Shach. Rav Shach passed away about 17 years ago. So one time they came to Rav Shach. In my shir on Shavuos, I talked to this a little bit. The idea of kicking kids out of a school is a tremendously weighty topic, but they came to Rav Shach, who was the leader, Gadol Hador, in the whatever time year it was, and they said, we have to kick out of a school, and Rav Shach agreed. 6 months later, the principal comes back and asks Rav Shach a separate question. He opens the door to Rav Shach's office, and there's this boy. So they said to Rav Shach, what's he doing here? He goes, who is he going to learn with? You kicked him out. I'm saying he had to learn with somebody. So I learned with him. All right. So that's also, it doesn't look like Sinas Chinam. It's for my community. I need to do this. I've carved out. I'm so tolerant of my people that I can't have this person. That's also Sinas Chinam. If you turn to the next page, all these different sources on the top here of which should be page 5. Rabbi Yitzchak says, Rabbi Amram says that the problem was we didn't rebuke each other. How can you have a society in which we're not telling each other we have to improve? That's not tolerant. That's intolerant. Everybody's great. And it goes on and on. And that's why I share with you this amazing idea from Rav Cook in source number 13, from an article from Rabbi Ries. Rabbi Ries quotes Rav Cook in a letter penned in 1932, identified in a separate pitfall with identification of a particular group of Jews, Haredim or Torah Jews, bemoaning the bifurcation of Jews in the Holy Land into Haredim and Chilonim. Rav Cook argued the age-old classification of Jews, this is great, Tzadikim, Beinonim, Rishayim, righteous, in the middle, and wicked, creates more inclusiveness and potential for tshuva. Otherwise, those who are Haredim, or don't, by the way, 1932, anybody in this room is a Haredi. We're not talking about Mitapayas and the Shrimal. We're talking about committed Jews. Or Frum may see no need to examine their own shortcomings. And those who are described as Chilonim may view themselves as beyond the pale of potential return. So, That, imagine if we had a society in which either we called ourselves Beinonim, Tzadikim, or Shaim. Nobody in this room is going to say, I'm a Rasha, right? I mean, maybe. Does anyone offer that? No. Is anybody really willing to say that they're a Tzadik? No. So what would you say? I'm a Beinoni. So a Beinoni means, Beinoni should not be interpreted, by the way, as average. No. Beinoni means I'm improving. I want to get there. I'm not average. Don't think average. So when the rabbi gets up in Rosh Hashanah and says, be a Beinoni, that's not what he means. Okay? Now, unfortunately, and as we approach Tisha B'Av, this is one of the things that we realize, unfortunately, in times of tragedy. When tragedy hits the Jewish people, there is no classification. There is no... It doesn't make a difference. We're all Jews. So I could quote you a number of sources, but I quoted you just a few. For example, number 14 of the Banu Hillel Seidman in the Warsaw Ghetto Diary is one of the most authoritative works in the Warsaw Ghetto. And says Hillel Seidman, he walked down into the streets as everybody else thirsting for news of the rumored deportations, only to discover that from this morning the ghetto had been surrounded by the Ukrainian militia. And he writes, and he continues to say that these include Latvians, Lithuanians, angels of destruction of every type. Anyone approaching the walls is shot on the spot. We aren't standing in a trap. Simon describes being caught with 1,000 other Jews funneled by the armed guards in English plots, the waiting area for the train station. There, cattle cars, freight wagons, normally used for transporting animals. I can tell you that when we take our students to the Holocaust Museum, and I have to give a tremendous hakaras hatov to Mrs. Pinchot for her unbelievable work on not just names and numbers, but in all of her Jewish history, and especially with the Holocaust, that the students really come out with, especially after 8th grade, with a tremendous personal connection with so many students, have no idea what a survivor looks like anymore, and now they have stories that they can tell their children, their grandchildren. I mean, the work that is being done is essential. When we take them to Holocaust Museum and they walk through the cattle car, that is for many of them their most frightening moment. So he says, here we are. These are animals, and they're waiting to deport them to their deaths. And so we march, old and young, women and children, rich and poor, in the lines of 8 abreast, according to the German system, and are many thousands. And the crowd stretches back as far as the eye can see. I think about this when I go to the Siyum HaShas every 7.5 years, and you're with tens of thousands, 90,000 Jews last time, the Siyum HaShas, right? So, and he writes the following, everybody presses together, so united in suffering, so totally in Am Echad, never before have I sensed so palpably the strand which binds us Jews together, our common cause, and our united purpose, like I do today on the death march. You know, there's so many stories like this in the Holocaust. Rafai Mashri, who wrote something called the Shalos and Tshuvas, I didn't quote it for you, but he wrote something called the Shalos and Tshuvas Mima Amakim. He was sort of the unofficial rub of the Covenant Ghetto. And many questions came to him accurate. I mean, these are things that actually happened. Both historical, halachic, I mean, it blows your mind listening to what people asked. And he answered them whatever he could. He hides these responsa. Later, they're uncovered. And then he gives all of the halachos and all the law behind what he... You imagine, I mean, I always say, I mean, I tell Ms. Nussman, I don't know how her father was a rabbi, because without the internet, I don't know how you could ever... And they're talking about in the ghetto. They had no sfarim, they had nothing. I mean, now you Google answers, it's fine. Everybody Googles things, right? I mean, don't tell anybody. It's just between us and the recorder. So, for just one child he got, there was a family that was so German. They were Jews, but they were so German, they never thought that they would be rounded up. And lo and behold, they're in the Covenant Ghetto. But they were so anti-religious, they never gave their son a bris milah. Now the boy's 20 or 21, and he says to Ephraim Ashri in the Covenant Ghetto, if I'm going to die with my brothers and sisters, I want to die as a Jew. So could I... And the only problem was, in the Covenant Ghetto, the only Moel was a Mechalo Shabbos. He didn't keep Shabbos. So whatever, end of the day, he said it was fine. But united in suffering. That was number one. Number two, unfortunately... You know, this year on Tisha B'Av in my show, I'll be sharing some of the stories of the three boys from a few summers ago. Hashemim kom damam. But Racheli Franco, who is a beacon of Amunah and of hope, I remember listening to a phone call that she was giving before, I mean, I guess at that point she had known the end, which is even more unbelievable. Listening to a phone call for rabbis the Thursday, right before they announced the news, and hearing her wasn't lip service. I mean, it was she is the Rabbi Akiva of 2000, of our generation. And what she said once was that Achdus Avas Yisrael, people feel what unfortunately has been around for quite some time. You remember this. This is 4 years ago. There was, I'm not that old, but I have people saying that they hadn't felt that united since 1967. And before that, maybe since 1948. Right? And she said the Haredi world is amazing. They share the Chiloni world, right? Haredi Chiloni working together. And if that's Achdus. And I'll share with you one more unbelievable idea before we conclude in a few minutes. We know that in the Beis HaMikdash, which we will talk about on Tishba, which obviously was destroyed, there were Kruvim, right? The cherubs, the Kruvim, which way did they face? So the Gemara says they fall. I don't know. Some by it seems that they're facing outward, some that they're facing inward. So what does the Gemara say? When we were worshiping God, they were facing towards each other. When we weren't facing God, they were facing outwards. Fine. Says the Gemara in Yuman, source 17. So when they entered the Beis HaMikdash, where were the Kruvim? Now you would imagine the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed because we weren't doing the will of God. So where should the Kruvim be facing? Outside. Yeah, they're facing, they're not just each other, they're embraced. The Kruvim were embraced. The Rishonim all, how is this possible? At a time that ain't osim ritzon shalom, you're not doing, doesn't make any sense. So a lot of good answers. So I'll tell you an answer that I heard from Rabbi Weinreb, who's executive vice president of OU, who gives a Tisha B'av many years, was my shul rabbi growing up, from the Belzer Rebbe. So a few years ago, somebody walked into the Belzer Rebbe's office. The Belzer Rebbe, you should just know, we're talking about tolerance. The Belzer Rebbe, the original Belzer Rebbe that came over from the Holocaust, there's an amazing amount of research in how people sacrificed for their Rebbes to survive. That was like their, it was their thing. They were going to help the Rebbe survive. Rabbi Herzog was very, the chief rabbi of Israel, was very influential in getting the Belzer Rebbe over to Israel. And in fact, when the Belzer Rebbe made her first wedding in Israel, after he came over, he lost his wife and children. Imagine today, you had a Hasidish wedding, you're not going to have the chief rabbi in Rabbi Herzog, the Zionist. He was the Mesader Kedusha. He felt that debt of Hakaras HaTov. The Belzer Rebbe, not that many years ago, made a wedding for a grandson. It was like the moment that the Belzer Hasidah said, we made it. We've reestablished ourselves. And that night, there was a terrorist attack. The Belzer Rebbe, he was waiting at the wedding. He waited. He said Tehillim. And the next morning, after the wedding, he went to make a Bikur Cholim called by those who were injured. So that's the Belzer Rebbe. The Belzer Rebbe said the following. Somebody walks into the Belzer Rebbe's office, and they say to the Belzer Rebbe, somebody, you know, not from our community, but somebody was just killed in a terrorist attack. So the Belzer Rebbe says, I don't need any more keys. That's what he says. I don't need any more keys. What does that mean? So the guy didn't want to ask him what this meant, but somebody else asked the Rebbe, what did you mean? He says that as Jews, we put up gates, right? And we have a gate for this, and sometimes it's okay to have a gate. And often during times of tragedy, that's something that unlocks those gates. The gates come down, and we're united. Then what happens? We forget, and we put those gates right back up. The Rebbe says, enough keys. I don't need any more keys. Often at times of tragedy, we find ourselves united. So I don't want to end on that note. So let me tell you a note that I would like to end on. How do we get to a point where we don't need a terrorist attack, and we don't need somebody sick, and because often what happens, and it's human nature, that as those moments fade off into the distant past, we forget about it, and we put those gates right back up, and we get right back up the thing in the way that I'm doing it is, and it takes a lot of vulnerability to be able to put the gates down, not just say that I love you, you're great, you're a Jew, that am I vulnerable to growth that comes from the power of a community, okay? So there's a great author. Her name is Brené Brown. Brené Brown wrote a number of books. I'm in the middle of one right now. It's called something about imperfection. But she wrote a book called Daring Greatly. And what she was bothered by, she said, what makes good people good people? Like the great people in history, what made them great? And basically, her research. She works in Houston, and now she speaks around the country. I'm a quarter of this Shabbos in Shul. She said, what makes great people great is vulnerability. When you're vulnerable and you're open to being honest about yourself and your shortcomings, that makes you a great person. When we let our guard down and we're vulnerable within a community, there's tremendous things that we can accomplish. So I want to offer a few suggestions. And I have 4 minutes left, but I can't not do the source, page number 7, this source number 18. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. It's worth noting because I feel I have to. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was one of the great Gedolim, lived until 1986. The only reason I'm standing here today is because of Yaakov Kamenetsky. Yaakov Kamenetsky, when he would travel, before he moved to America, would travel from Europe to raise money. In those days, right, the Rosh Yeshivas came, not they didn't send somebody. And he stayed, when he would go to Canada, he went to Hamilton. So, I don't know how many know Hamilton in Canada, whatever it is, Hamilton, Ontario. That's where my family, I have some family from there. That's where my grandfather was from. So, my grandfather had, there were four brothers and one sister. And Yaakov Kamenetsky would stay by my great-grandparents. And there was no Jewish day schools. So at some point, Rav Yaakov says to my great-grandparents, listen, you got to send the boys to yeshiva. You don't send the boys to yeshiva, they're not going to be from. So my great-grandparents didn't have enough money. So they just sent my uncle, my great-uncle, who was a rabbi in Akron, Ohio for 40 years, and my Zadie, to Neir Yisrael in Baltimore, who was just starting, to learn. And lo and behold, Rav Yaakov's vision was right. The rest of my great-uncles, who were great people, did not remain from. And my great uncle was a rabbi, and my grandfather was a teacher in Baltimore for many years. Stay from. So it's a tremendous amount of emotion that I share anytime I share pieces of Torah from Yaakov Kamenetsky. But he has perhaps one of the most profound ideas on tolerance. And I'm going to read a line or two inside because it's so beautiful. But he asks a very simple question. At the end of Bamidbar, we get flags. Everybody go, parade, we get a flag. Every Shevet had a different flag. So he really asks two questions. He says, why in the world would we give every Shevet a different flag? Different color, different symbol. All I'm going to think about is, my flag is better than your flag. Ha, your flag doesn't have that. My symbol looks better. My color is more pretty. Whatever it is. Prettier. And then he says, and if we're going to get flags, why do we wait to get them in Bamidbar? When the Jews left Egypt, they left according to their tribe. So why not on the way out of Egypt, to Moshe's like there, handing you your flag. Right? Like Simchas Torah. And he offers it, this is what you should take away. He says the following. Look at the second paragraph. I got 2 minutes. Elo be'emes and yinhad de galim. The idea of flags, l'cha'ora, he pirut ha'levavos. It should really create strife, dissension, animosity. How come it doesn't do that? Skip down about 6 lines. Ela mikevan shulchulam merkaz echad. That's what I'll tell you, that one line. The reason God waited to give them the flag is because they waited until they had the Mishkan. So when they had the Mishkan and they had a center, then God says, this is the best time to give you the flag. So you should realize you're all going about it in different ways, but you're going towards the same place. Had they gotten leaving Egypt, each one would have said, oh, my flag is so much better than your flag. But now my flag leads you to the Mishkan, your flag, all going to the same place. We just had different ways of going about it. Now, sometimes you can get a flag that's not accepted. And that happens. And we have to, those also times need rebuke and need understanding. But to understand that we're all going to the same place. We're all open to how we get there. And my way of getting there might need some tweaking. And maybe your way needs some tweaking. Maybe your way needs to be cut out. But we're all in the same place. And that's really an idea. And that's what I hope is the antithesis of sinas chinam. Because if sinas chinam at its core isn't that I just hate you, it's that I believe that the way that I've decided to worship God is the right way, and the way to fix that isn't just by loving everybody, it's by understanding that there are different approaches. It doesn't mean that the guy that wants to sleep and never daven and never do any mitzvahs, that's your way. That also needs a loving and warmth and care and concern and respect and admiration, and but doesn't mean it's right, but it doesn't need you to be nasty. How do we get we're all going towards the same place? And that's why in davening, I'll share with you two ideas in davening. Number one, there is an idea of the Arizal. Before you start davening, you're supposed to accept the mitzvah of V'yahavta b'reacha kamocha. Why not? I'm davening to God, just me and God. How in the world are you going to talk to God if you can't respect your person down here? And that's why in Kedusha, when we say V'kara zeh, al zeh, why do we turn to each other? Right? Because before I could say Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh to Hashem, I got to make sure that I'm okay with the people down here. And that's the idea. Sinas chinam is not just baseless hatred. It's an attitude that I have. It's a pathology that I believe in. It's an ideal that I have decided what's best for me. And therefore, anybody that is to right, to left, or to center right, center left, to from centrist, centrist, from centrist, from birth, orthodox. Does it make a difference? I know the right way. Being open, being vulnerable, feeling that we need this sense of community, that's what it means. And I'll end with one story. There's a great story from Yosef Klein Halevi, Like Dreamers, that you can read. This idea of that there's no religious paratroopers or secular, there's just paratroopers. But I want the story at the bottom. I'll tell you the story outside. And then I really got to end because it's lunch. The story is told about the great Kleisenberger Rebbe. The Kleisenberger Rebbe lost his wife and 11 children in the Holocaust. Comes to America, rebuilds, builds Kiryat Sanz, all that is his vision. And he was traveling with Chassidim Davin Mincha very, very late. Whatever, we're not going to into it, the Davin Mincha late. And they go, they're in a trip to Israel, and they have a very tight schedule, and they go to visit the kever of Rabbi Yehuda, the great Tana, who said you can only daven mincha until early in the afternoon, and they daven mincha late. All right, whatever. The next day, the Kleisenberg says, I got to go back. We got to go back. He goes, we got a tight schedule. I got to go back. I said, why do you have to go back? So we go back, they daven mincha early, early, like the time that Rabbi Yehuda says you could daven. They said, you never daven mincha this early. He says, I don't daven mincha this early. But how could I, at the kever of Rabbi Yehuda, not respect his opinion? And that I believe, this karozeh ozeva amar, kadosh, 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 that's the antithesis. That's the antidote to sinas chinam. Not just I'm going to love you with no real terms, but that I have an idea that I have to work on something myself about respect and understanding respect towards what you do, respecting that I might not think the way, we might not think the same, but we're all in the same boat. And that maybe I do need some work. And if we can fix ourselves individually, we come together and fix our community together. Everybody should have a very meaningful Tishrav and a great rest of your week. Yeah, sure.